I'm Laura Kahn. I chair the Environmental Advisory Council. And I will go around and you can unmute yourselves and introduce yourselves. We will start with the members of the Environmental Advisory Council. Kathy? Kathy, we can't hear you if you're here. She was here. You're here. Okay. Well, Kathy,
I am here.
Oh, good. Hi.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yep. That's better.
Sorry about that. I'm on a different device and I couldn't find the button. I'm Kathy Fay, I work at Neighborhood Housing Services, and I'm happy to be a member of the Environmental Advisory Council.
Great. Okay, Kevin.
Kevin McCarthy, I'm the vice chair.
Kristen.
Hi, Kristen Gordon, member of the Advisory Council and resident of Ward 22.
Iris.
Iris Kaminsky.
Great. Okay. And now we will go to, let's see, Dawn Henning.
Good evening, everyone. Dawn Henning, assistant city engineer, and I help staff the council.
And it is thanks to Dawn that we have this meeting, because Dawn does all the logistics. We will go to Giovanni.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Giovanni Zinn. I'm the city engineer.
And Senator Looney.
Yep, Martin Looney, State Senator, 11th District.
And let's see, Catherine Lamar.
Hi, I'm sorry, I have no voice tonight. I'm Catherine Lamar, I'm Deputy Corporation Counsel for the city.
Welcome, Sally Cruz.
That I was on mute. Sally Cruz, I'm with the New Haven Port Authority.
Welcome, Chris Ozick.
Hi, Chris, Urban Resource Initiative.
Jeannie DeBino.
Hi, I'm Jeannie DeBino. I'm a concerned citizen, concerned about many environmental issues, including noise pollution, chemical pollution, all manner of pollution, and general well-being.
Patricia Hauser.
Hi, I'm actually visiting from Milford. I'm a member of the Milford Environmental Concerns Coalition, and I enjoy eavesdropping and learning from your conversations.
Well, thank you. Let's see, Mary Woolsey.
I'm Mary Woolsey. I'm a New Haven resident concerned about environmental issues.
Stephanie Fitzgerald.
Stephanie Fitzgerald from the West River Watershed Coalition and the Friends of Edgewood Park, and Frank Cochran also. Same Great. Organization.
Okay, Lou Birch.
Hey, everybody. Good evening. It's Lou Rosato Birch. Try to change my name on here, but it wouldn't allow me to. Anyway, I am the program director at Citizens Campaign for the Environment. I'm primarily here as a resident. I live on West Prospect Street.
Gene Connolly.
I live on York Street, and I have a lot of land trust experience. I'm looking forward to this evening's presentation. Thank you.
Lynn Bonnet.
I'm Lynn Bonnet. I'm part of the New Haven Bioregional Group and the Greater New Haven Green Fund.
Welcome. And Madeline Kahn, who happens to be my daughter and is going to help share things. So if you see her put things in the chat or things on the screen, you can thank her for having more technical ability than I do. Introduce yourself.
I'm Madeline. I'm tech support.
And a concerned citizen. Sochi.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sochi. I work through Gather New Haven as an urban farmer, and I'm also a New Haven resident concerned about the environment.
and hopefully one day an Environmental Advisory Council member. Florestine? We can't hear you. You're on mute.
Hi. Hear me now?
Yep.
Okay. Florestine Hill Advisory Board member. Happy New Year to everyone.
Thanks. You too. Let's see who else is here. Well, I'm happy to report that we have our brand new appointed aldermanic representative taking Alder Sal DiCola's place, which is great for us and also sad for us because we admire Sal for all the work he's done for us. But we have our new representative with us, and that is Steve Winter. Want to introduce yourself, Steve?
Hi, good evening, everyone. I'm also very appreciative of Alder DiCola's work, and he has promised to remain involved and help out however needed, and also help me, you know, as I transition and get up to speed with stuff. But I'm excited to be part of the group and to help however I can. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you. Okay, I think that's everybody. Great. Who's on? Oh, the person who's on iPhone. Would you like to introduce yourself? If you would, this is your chance.
That person left a message in the chat.
I know. That's why
It's me. It's Chris.
Oh, hi. Okay.
I got on your phone. Sorry. I haven't.
It's okay. Great. Okay, and we've just been joined by Aisha Woods. Want to introduce yourself, Aisha?
Hi, I'm Aisha Woods, Director of City Plan. I may not be able to stay for the whole meeting, but I was interested in the presentation.
Great. Okay, we will try and get to it right away. So I just have a few things that Madeline's going to put in the chat. If anybody else comes and you notice them and anybody wants to introduce themselves, please interrupt us or put your name in the chat. Or, you know, if you notice that anybody has joined us, feel free to put their names in the chat. Let's see. So Madeline saw a couple of articles that she thought were germane to our conversation. One is about de-icing salt and water pollution. She just put a link to that in the chat. And the other is about Amazon and plastic. So since we're talking about water this evening, I haven't yet introduced our guests, by the way, did I? Gary, I missed Gary.
Yep, right. Are
you here?
Gary Zrelick with the Greater New Haven Water Pollution Control Authority.
Hi, so sorry about that, Gary. We are honored to have you with us.
Okay.
Anyone who wants can click on those links that are in the chat box, and then you'll be able to see what's in them. And I will put them in the minutes, and we will send the minutes around so you'll be able to see them that way too. So Madeline also put in the chat a link to the Environmental Advisory Council webpage on the city website. Thanks to Dawn for recording all our meetings and for making sure that that is kept up to date. We really appreciate that. And let's see, let us go on. So we will not be meeting next month. Instead, we encourage everybody to attend two more meetings this month on January 11th, which is next Tuesday, I think. Yeah, right? Yeah. Dawn's intern is going to give a presentation to the Climate Emergency Mobilization Task Force about the greenhouse gas inventory of the city. Is that correct, Dawn?
Yes, 6 o'clock. I could put the information to join the meeting in the chat as well.
It's already there.
Madeline, it's already there. Oh, okay, you're quick. Okay, great. A fellow last summer that conducted a greenhouse gas inventory for 2019 that she was going to present the findings of.
Fantastic. We will look forward to that. And so
we'll record it as well for anyone who can't make it.
Thank you. And I'll send that Zoom link around in an email after this meeting. I didn't want to send too many Zoom links in one email because I figured people might get mixed up about which was which. So the other meeting we urge everyone to attend is a webinar that's going to be presented by Vote Solar. It's a PURA 101 primer on what PURA, the Public Utilities Regulation Authority, does, because we have many EAC members interested in everything to do about our electricity. And so before we invite someone from PURA to come and answer our questions, we thought we should get a jump on it by attending this meeting first. So it's January 18th, 12:30 to 1. That doesn't make sense. A half an hour? I don't know. Maybe I have it mixed up. But anyway, there is a link to join that webinar. To register for that webinar, you have to register for it in the chat. So I think that's it. We will meet again in March. Hopefully sometime soon we will have a public hearing concerning leaf blowers, which we have been working on. And let's see, I think we're going to, one thing, the Environmental Advisory Council was asked by Quiet Communities, which is working on leaf blowers and lots of other noise issues, to draft a letter to the EPA administrator, 12:30 to 2. Thank you, Dawn. Anyway, we were asked to draft a letter to the EPA administrator concerning refunding the noise abatement and control office. And so maybe Madeline can put that document in the chat, but I can send it around after this. She could share it with you, but I think it's better just, she put it in the chat already. So thank you, Madeline. Okay. So we submitted several questions to Steve and Tiffany and Gary in advance. And let me, Madeline, do you want to share? Yeah, Madeline put that in the screen. We can go through those in any order you like. I suggest that first we start with, let's start with something that I think might be a good introduction. So if the three of you, Steve and Tiffany and Gary, want to give us a brief introduction of what you do at your respective companies, that would probably be helpful to the people who don't know. Steve, do you want to start?
Sure thing. Good evening, everybody. My name is Steve Vitko. I'm the Senior Environmental Analyst at the Regional Water Authority. Really, I work with environmental planning on many different environmental issues regarding the water industry, and essentially how we can keep that water as safe and as clean as possible in the raw form before it enters our water treatment plant for a couple of things. One, keeping the water clean and healthy for us and the environment, and also reducing the treatment costs at the water treatment plants, obviously keep operational costs down. So we'll get more into that today, but looking forward to it. So nice to see everybody.
Thank you. Okay, Tiffany.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Tiffany Lufkin. I'm the Senior Planning Engineer at the Regional Water Authority. I do long-range capital forecast planning for the authority, including demand forecasting, as well as various other things with our capital infrastructure improvements program, such as budgeting and assisting with funding through the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund, which is issued through the Connecticut Department of Public Health in terms of funding for some projects.
Great, thank you. And Gary?
Yes, Gary Zrelick. I'm the Director of Operations for the Greater New Haven Water Pollution Control Authority. We operate the water pollution control plant at East Shore, off of East Shore Parkway there. We have 550 miles of pipes. Our service area is New Haven, East Haven, Hamden, Woodbridge, a small part of North Brantford. We service that area for wastewater facilities here. One of our larger issues as a city there is we're a CSO community, combined sewer overflow. We do have a long-term control plan that is addressing that.
Our plant is compliant with most of our nutrient removal controls that we have there. And we've been working on our collection system under a capacity management and operations plan to, you know, reduce backups and overflows in that community there. So that's kind of what I do on the daily basis. We also have a finance department and engineering department for the authority.
Thank you. Okay, so I'm going to start by springing a small surprise on Steve and Tiffany, and I don't know if this applies to Greater New Haven Water Pollution Control Authority too, but April Capone told me that you recycle a lot of things such as toothpaste tubes and stuff. So give us a little overview of the interesting things you collect and what happens to them.
Sure, I can chime in there. So one person at our company, one of the questions you actually had for us was if we have some sort of sustainability officer. And I think you gave a link to a gentleman in Orlando, Florida. And although it's not the exact definition as what the gentleman in Orlando, Florida does, we have many other things that we focus on here in the Connecticut region, just because the sustainability efforts differ from region to region. But in terms of the recycling program that you're talking about, April is exactly correct. Our sustainability officer put in this program that actually we can now recycle oral care products such as toothbrushes, and we're actually adding K-cups next year in 2022, because of course there's still K-cup machines floating around the office, and some people do still use those. Not the most environmentally friendly products out there, so we wanted to come up with a way to recycle those as well. But there's much more going on as well. As far as energy goes, we actually completed an equipment replacement for projects for electrical projects, resulting in over 1 million kilowatt hours of reduction in energy since 2018. So that's one thing we've been doing on the energy side of things. And we've also looked into multiple sustainable energy sources within all of our water treatment plants and some of our well fields. In fact, one of our well fields in Hamden actually has a 1 megawatt solar array. We use this to supply energy because the pumping process at the well fields is pretty extensive. So we actually use this to supplement some of the energy at that particular well field. Let's see, I wrote down a couple other things here because we have a pretty extensive list. We're beginning evaluation of water use at all the RWA water treatment plants. So really, the water treatment plants themselves utilize a lot of water, even though that's what they're distributing. So we're actually coming up with ways to reduce the amount of water that we actually utilize at our water treatment plants to reduce our overall capacity as a whole. We've completed multiple waste studies over the years, which is basically figuring out what we throw away and what we recycle, and trying to change the minds of our own employees by way of kind of signage and emails, and trying to get people to do the right thing and recycle the right products in the right place, which we've actually had a great success with. Actually, a better recycling program. Along with that, we were actually in 2020 awarded the Association of Metropolitan Water Agencies Sustainability Water Utility Management Award. And it was actually a pretty big feat for us. We had to apply for this and basically put in all these things that we've been working on, and along with many other large metropolitan water companies in the country. And we were actually selected as the winner for that in 2020. And one of my favorites is actually the Pollinator Pathway Initiative that we've been doing since early 2020 to now. We've actually implemented two pollinator pathways, one at our 90 Sargent Drive facility in New Haven and the other in Hamden on Waite Street. And what we're trying to do is change public perception minds by having them see the actual pollinator pathways at our facilities, and digging up that grass, which, you know, which sometimes needs to be irrigated, and otherwise creating a garden area that not only requires almost zero irrigation, but also creates a habitat for native species. So it's just some of the things we've been working on in a sustainability effort.
Wow. All that sounds amazing. So the energy, is that hydropower? Is that how you...
We do actually have hydropower as well. Tiffany, do you know a little more about the hydropower?
I'm not familiar with the size, but at one of actually our largest surface water treatment plant, the water flows by gravity down from the lake into the treatment plant, and we do capture some of the energy through that, through a hydro generator located at that facility. The energy is used at that plant. That has been kind of in place for quite a long time. The solar array at Wellfield is one of our newer initiatives. So that is one way that we kind of capture the water, capture the energy in the water that we can use on site for the treatment process there.
Great. I'm just going to interrupt you for 1 second to note that our newest Environmental Advisory Council member, Doreen Abubakar, has joined us. Welcome. She's been here for a little while, but I forgot to say that. So Doreen, do you want to just unmute yourself and say hi?
Hello. And welcome.
Okay. So tell me, what happens to those toothpaste tubes and K-cups after you collect them? I'm just curious if there's a way we general citizens, I don't use K-cups, but I do use toothpaste tubes, besides trying to use like powdered tooth cleaner, what can one do with a used toothpaste tube?
Right. That I actually don't know. I know about the initiative, and I've seen the actual cardboard boxes to put them in. Although the K-cup one, like I said, is going to be implemented in 2022. But I can get back to you with what they're actually doing with these things.
Steve, I have a little bit of information.
Oh, you do? Good, good.
Yep. So we're collecting it currently for employees. So any employee can bring their products in. And it is through a program called TerraCycle. I don't believe there's a fee for the company or the individual to send the product. I believe it's an offshoot of the Colgate brand, but the products don't need to be manufactured by that company in order for them to accept them. And it can be pretty much anything related to oral care. So your toothbrush themselves, when they wear out, even the heads of the electronic ones, as well as the boxes and packaging in the toothpaste tubes. So that was one initiative. It came out of our sustainability team, which is made up of employees at the Regional Water Authority who volunteer to participate. So that was one of the initiatives of the team over, I'd say, the last 6 months, was to see if there was a way for some of our home hygienic products to be recycled at work.
Wow, that's amazing. It's good to know where toothpaste and toothbrushes can go, because we always have that question in our house. And congratulations on your sustainability award. We're thrilled that our water company won such an award. Wonderful. So Gary, I wonder if the water pollution company has any sustainability initiatives we should know about.
In sustainability, well, you talked about recycling there, you know, the major thing. I think the new term really for wastewater treatment facilities are the WRRFs, Water Resource Recovery Facilities, because really our whole job is cleaning up the water that came from RWA to the people who then put various components into it. They bring that down to us and we take them back out and then discharge it to New Haven Harbor and our aspect there. So we've always been a recycling facility there. Looking at that, you know, one of the things we've looked at is energy efficiency. You know, the treatment plants use a lot of electricity. So we're always doing efficiency aspects and changing out that equipment. We did put in a waste heat recovery facility from our incinerator. So it makes steam, it turns a turbine and produces electricity. It can produce up to 25% of our plant's power. You know, we use 24 million kilowatt hours a year there. So that's a sizable portion there. It is the first one in the country on a multiple hearth incinerator. So we have had various operating difficulties with it, but it's, it really saves on the electricity and has an offset there. Looking at that. So that's pretty much, where we are as a sustainable one. We're always looking at, a lot of the issues coming down to us are really about source control, because if you've been on some of my tours, they're always we walk through what stuff that we're taking out here of the screening, the plastics and all those materials that come down, and I like to point out that we're not a manufacturing facility. Everything you see at the process and what comes into us is from you people in the system, what you flush down the toilet, dump down the drain, this is what comes to us. And so we're cleaning that up. So anything that helps to improve the people out in the community, do more environmentally sound things and not, flushing them down the toilet is a big benefit to us. So we're always proactive about that, pushing about the whole plastics, the wipes issue, they clog up our pumps. They don't break down like, if you always, you see toilet paper, one drop of water, it disintegrates. These industrial, wipes that they say are flushable, that's because they can make it out of your toilet is their definition of flushable, but then they get stuck on our pumps, cause us, problems that way. And then the other thing is always fog, fats, oils, and grease, that people shouldn't be dumping those kind of things down into the system there. So we're putting out, if we have problems with backups in the system, we'll put door hangers out and notifying, the neighborhoods that contributed to that area to, watch what you put down the drain there. So some of those are some of our, active programs that are continuing.
Well, thank you. Sounds like everybody has a lot of stuff under control. So I do, the one thing that the sustainability officer at the Orlando utilities does that I don't know that anyone does in our neck of the woods is he goes around and checks people's sprinkler systems to make sure that their sprinklers are not spraying the sidewalks and that they're doing it at the correct time of day, which is really early in the morning, and that people are trying not to waste water. And I understand that we have more water than other people, but my theory is that we need to learn how to conserve resources in general, and that everything matters. And if you waste one resource, you're going to waste another. So for instance, if you're running your sprinkler in the middle of the afternoon and you're flushing the wrong thing down the toilet, you're doing other things, you're putting stuff in your blue recycling bin that doesn't belong, and you're doing all kinds of other stuff. So I'm just wondering, I understand that perhaps this is a municipality by municipality thing, a sustainability officer, but I am wondering if the water quality part of our life wouldn't benefit from someone who goes around and checks to make sure we're all behaving the way we should with our precious water resource.
Yeah, so we don't have necessarily an individual who goes around to all the sprinkler systems like Orlando does. However, we have, I want to say, kind of like the next best thing to that, which is our watershed inspection program. And our educational kind of sustainability standards that we have. So the first thing, like I said, is the watershed inspection program. So for those of you who don't know, Department of Public Health actually regulates, they regulate us. And one of the regulations is that all water companies with an active source of water supply needs to conduct an annual survey of their watershed lands. And so one thing we do is we go out to everything from the golf courses to the industrial buildings to the, sometimes the agricultural areas, especially the construction sites. We go out to all those things and inspect them for potential issues or pollutants that may cause a problem or a negative impact to our water quality. So, like I said, we need to go out to basically all these areas, and that includes places with, of course, irrigation. Two main areas that come to mind are golf courses and, industrial or commercial buildings. So although we're looking more for chemical hazards, chemical and oils and, we'll say the hazards that are more associated with like gas stations, we'll say gasoline, oils, chemical hazards. We also look for things like leaking sprinkler heads. We look for potential problems that may result in water loss. It's not part of the regulation, but that's something that we kind of add to it because obviously we, as much as you guys, don't want to see, a pipe leaking over here or a sprinkler head leaking over there because that's going against what we want to see. So for example, golf course, we'll look for chemical storage of pesticides or fertilizers, whatever they may be using, making sure that those are stored properly so that if anything was to happen or if the building was to flood, let's say, those wouldn't become a part of the storm flow. We look for things like cart washing and trying to minimize or have them do that in a confined area in order to not allow for that to wash into the public water supply or the watershed. And we'll also look into their management practices with irrigation and make sure that they're watering at the correct times of days. And the best thing that we can basically offer is to have a licensed professional manage your system. So for commercial buildings, for residential sites, for industrial buildings, we always try to preach don't irrigate because, it's not often necessary. But if you do have to irrigate, just have a licensed professional work on it because they're the ones that know what they're going to do. They're the ones that know what to do. And you oftentimes overlook things that they may see. So it's all about education. And in fact, in 2021, we actually held, or RWA held a sustainable water use series. So it was 4 weeks and each week was a different presenter. I was actually one of the presenters on that, teaching people about how to properly utilize their irrigation systems, how to properly water if you are going to irrigate. But of course, what I always tried to put the message across is the alternatives to irrigation, which are, rain gardens, bioswales, pollinator pathways, something that's going to rip out that grass so that you don't need to irrigate in the first place. So it's really a matter of education. And the other thing that you guys may have all seen in the summer is our little snips on News Channel 8. We try to put out some water wise tips every once in a while. And that's during usually high peak flow demand days on the heat of summer. And that's a way that we try to get our message across to the public.
My screen gave up. Can I join yours?
To jump off of what Steve said, a little plug. In 2016 through 2019, we did a major infrastructure project where all of our customer communication devices, the meters that are in the customers' homes, were updated so that we can collect that meter information remotely. And as part of that, we're actually able to record those meter readings every hour. Since that project has been completed, we've rolled out with a new portal for our customers. So customers can log on through our website and they can access all of that same information that the utility is getting from their meter. So they can actually see how much water they're using on an hour by hour basis. And you can have that system set up alerts for you. It can come in, I believe, via email. So if there is a period of time that where you have continuous use, which would be an indication that you have a leak in your system, that could be somewhere in your house, a running toilet, or it could be an issue with the irrigation system that you may or may not have, you can have an alert sent to you so that you'd be aware of that leak and be able to address it before it runs on for a longer period of time. You can also set them up for high use. So if there's something, if something goes awry with your washing machine or another appliance that's using a lot of water, that where you would have a very high demand for a particular hour, or perhaps you had a pipe burst in your house, you can get an alert for that too. So we're trying to give our customers more information so that they can make those decisions about
using water wisely and making sure that everything that they have on their side of the system is really only using water where they really intend to.
Thank you, Tiffany. I'm sorry, my computer froze, so I switched to Madeline's. Okay, I see we have a lot of questions. We're going to go on to try to get some answers to the questions we asked before the meeting, because we had a specific set of information we would like to know. And so I think I'm just going to ask the first question. So we've noticed that there are a lot of people building new developments and turning old buildings into residential developments. And there are a lot of educational buildings being built and commercial buildings. And we are wondering what the impact of more water consumers will be, such as those who would occupy the proposed 500 apartment complex on Long Wharf, new apartment complexes on the West River in Westville, in Dixwell Plaza, on Audubon and Orange Street, in Worcester Square, and at English Station, should that ever happen, and more and bigger commercial and residential structures. And the second part of that question is, who pays for those infrastructure updates? Is it the developers of the projects, or is it the rate and taxpayers? And the third part of that question is, if there's a significant increased demand in the territory, the water and sewer company cover, what are the mechanisms to ensure drinking water even in drought, and what constitutes a significant increase in demand? I know that's a lot to swallow. I can repeat it, but any of the three of you, feel free to start.
Absolutely, I can chime in. First off, from 1999 to 2021, I had a chart that I put up on screen, but I'll just kind of describe it to you guys. So from 1999 to 2021, we have seen an average average decline in average day usage of water from 11 million gallons. Sorry, that was poorly stated. But from 1999 to 2021, we've seen a decline in 11 million gallons a day in water usage. So we factor this in that there's many different factors for this, but one in particular is high efficiency and low flow appliances that are being installed. That's a really big thing. Everyone's trying to install them because obviously no one wants to pay for water. And everyone wants, not everyone, but most people want a more sustainable product. So that's one thing that we've seen. Another thing is that there used to be a lot of industry in the New Haven area, and a lot of the industry has been being outsourced to other countries, other states, other areas. And industry is a huge factor in water demand. And without that industry, a thousand houses can produce, maybe one industry could produce. It's, they produce a lot more water. And without that industry, we think that the numbers are going to continue to decline in the future. And the other thing is with new structures going up, new educational facilities, as you said, new, maybe businesses and things to that degree, most new infrastructure is being implemented with this low flow technology already. And usually they're being implemented with sustainable aspects to them. Even when it comes to stormwater treatment, we've been seeing it's just a normal thing now for site plans to come in with stormwater treatment, low flow appliances, and more water saving technology. So overall, we've been seeing a decline in water usage over the years. So we really don't feel that the any apartment complexes or new facilities are going to, be an issue for our water or for our water supply, we'll say. And I know that Tiffany's been working on multiple things like population studies and studies like that she's probably going to want to talk about as well.
Yeah. Great. So in 2019, we updated our population and water demand study. That is a forecast looking out over the next 50 years of what we might anticipate water demand and changes would look like due to population changes, as well as other contributing factors, a large one of which is those interior appliances that Steve talked about. What we're seeing now, although a lot of those changes in efficiency were originally sparked by updates and requirements in the plumbing code, nowadays, consumers are buying appliances that are even more efficient than the regulations require. So we do forecast that that will continue and that residential end uses of water are going to continue to decline, at least in the indoor use. We would hope that the educational efforts of groups such as this can contribute to decrease in outdoor watering use as well. To sum up that project, which I just want to add, did include potential projected impacts of climate change on water use over that forecast period of 50 years. The results indicate that we in the New Haven region would anticipate a continued declining trend of water demand like we have seen over the last 20 years through about the 2045 timeframe. And then population and urban growth kind of outweighs some of those increases in efficiency, and we might see a slight bend before returning to water demands that are similar to what we see today around the 2065 timeframe. So over the next 50 years, taking all of those things into account, these expected developments that you mentioned, we would not anticipate a large change in our water demand because it is being offset by some of those other factors.
Sorry. Thank you, Tiffany. That was my computer rebooting again. I apologize. I hope that we can have as much of this information as you have in charts and stuff for our minutes as you are willing to share with us, because it sounds like great information. So, okay. So that tells us that we're not going to have too many water customers, but who pays for the hookups for new buildings, and especially places where there is not currently water or sewer? And I realize I didn't ask Gary if he wants to chime in on the impact.
Well, listen, as I always kind of joke with RWA, I mean, we're just the other end of the pipe. So their decline in consumption is mirrored in the water flow coming to the facility for our treatment. So that works in our favor. So there's plenty of capacity. And any new place coming in, we're part of the plan review process. And so that we look locally to make sure that the, pipes in that area have the capacity. But we do have a lot of large pipes. So the capacity is never usually too much of an issue on that end. So same kind of things there, the decline in water consumption follows with us.
Great.
Laura, can I make a small addition?
Yes, of course, Kevin. Go ahead.
So there's a systems problem here. There's a contradiction between how the utilities pay their bills and a number of the public policies that we're interested in.
What does that mean?
Both the water utilities and the sewer authority pay their bills by selling water or selling services. And both of them have very high fixed costs. In other words, there are costs associated with both sets of pipelines that have to be paid regardless of how much water is consumed or how much sewage is created. What happens is they have an economic incentive to sell more water. They're making good faith efforts to promote public policies by selling less water, but that is a contradiction. And going to Mary's question about gray water, the same thing applies there, where there are a number of places where it would make sense to use less than fully treated water for non-consumptive uses, but it would cost the utilities money. And this is not the utilities being evil. I mean, the utilities, the water company makes money by selling water. And if it doesn't sell enough water, it doesn't pay its bills. The WPCA makes its revenues based on how much water gets sold. If the amount of water that was sold dropped precipitously, they couldn't cover their costs. And we have basically a systems problem. And this is something that PURA has been dealing with and the other utilities. The business model that we have for the utilities is you need to sell more to cover your costs. Again, it's not a matter of people being evil. It's a matter of, you know, we need to pay our bills.
And so, okay. So they've come up with ways to make their own energy and do some other things that give them perhaps better control.
Those are all good things. And the folks who are speaking tonight are doing really good work. That's a fairly small part of their cost of doing business. Okay. I mean, it's a good thing. And the folks here are doing really good work. Their revenue stream is based on how much they sell.
Right. Okay. Well, I still want to know who pays for infrastructure updates and
I can answer that question for you, Laura.
Right. Thanks.
And I'd like to address Kevin's point as well.
Right.
Perfect. Let's answer the question first. So per our rules and regulations, a developer is typically responsible for paying for the water main extensions and any additional infrastructure that's needed to serve their development. So that is also true for a new individual customer if they would like to be served. Or if they're performing major renovations, which require an update to their service, they are responsible for the cost. If in the event that a developer paid pipe is planned for installation and it would benefit the RWA's larger system to perhaps install a larger pipe or to complete a looped connection that would be in addition to what that developer specifically needs, the RWA does fund that increased portion of the improvement that would benefit the greater good associated with that main extension. In some cases, we may choose to fund new pipe installations and extensions ourselves. It's not common. One example that I had thought of was, I believe in 2017 in Brantford, there were two streets which did not previously have water service. Where the home wells were found to be contaminated. And we did elect to extend service to those residences so that they would not be without safe water in their homes. So that would be an example of a pipe extension that the RWA funded. It's not typical. It was found that that extension of service would pay itself back over the life of that investment. So we were reaching enough customers adding them to our customer service would pay for the pipe that we had put in for them. That is the answer to the new construction. They are responsible for that themselves in most cases. For Kevin's point, we in the Northeast, I think we haven't seen as aggressive levels of conservation as some other areas of the country, particularly areas of the country that have been dealing with drought. Most notably, I think people may be familiar with California over the last 5 or 7 years, as well as Georgia in particular, have had some pretty severe droughts, and the conservation that was required by those consumers was pretty high. And the trend that we've kind of seen on a national level to address that conflict that you brought up, Kevin, is actually a change in the rate structure. So rather than having customers pay based on how much water they use, and even some water utilities have rate cases where it gets cheaper the more water you buy, some of these utilities in the water-stressed areas have changed their rate structure so it becomes more expensive the more water that you buy. That is a long-term sustainability change that we will see water utilities kind of move towards as conservation efforts and as water demands kind of decline in certain areas of the country. That is a way to promote conservation and also the financial side of the business sustainable. It's not something that our DVA is currently pursuing right now, but it's something that we're aware of and something that other utilities, maybe not in this region, but nationally in the country, are using as a solution to that problem.
Thank you. Gary, what do you have to add to that?
Basically the same thing for the infrastructure costs. You know, there's a, we basically go through a plan review. We know what's going to come in. They have to do a connection fee. We have a chart, which is actually based on their water meter size. So the size of the water meter that you're going to put on this building is what we base our connection fee on, because for the most part, water in is water out. You know, there, if they have a big irrigation system, we'll do a deduct for that kind of thing. So, you know, and that's onto the developer or the homeowner, whoever's connecting into the system for that to go on there. To adjust it, you know, our user fee, when you go through that part of it, that's we have to estimate, and we use the records from our WA, we have to estimate how much flow is going to come to us. You know, you have the option to, I guess, use water or not use water. And so then, you know, so what's coming into your house, but that can affect then what's coming to us. And what Kevin said there is basically it is a lot of fixed costs. I mean, we have this large facility that operates there, and, you know, it's designed for 40 million gallons a day. But, you know, you have to kind of have the personnel and equipment there to the your independent costs. Your variable costs are minor in comparison. So it's a large fixed cost. So it's estimating then our budget is how much flow is going to come to us. And then to divide that into the budget we need to operate it, which is mandated by the regulations. You know, when you have a sewer authority like that, is that you have to charge what it costs you to operate the facility, because it's for the public good on that end of it. So that's how we, you know, then develop those costs.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Yeah, this is just wanted to note, I have to get on a COVID-related call at 6:30. So I don't, that's, I have about 20 minutes more.
Okay. Senator Looney, is there anything specific you would like to ask the water and sewer people?
No, I understood there was a presentation that was going to be made, that I wanted to be able to see that. I had no questions for the people who've spoken so far.
We're just sort of having a discussion more than a presentation. Because
I said I've got to get on another call at 6:30, but it's very interesting.
Senator, which topic were you interested in on the agenda?
No, I thought there was going to be an overall presentation by on behalf of the group, but if there's not, I'm just interested to whatever is discussed until I have to leave.
Okay, thank you. Well, the idea of this evening is to try and get some of our questions about water and water conservation and water pollution and things like that answered. So I hope we are helping answer some of those questions. So I think we have a lot of answers. So I assume that we just have enough water, even in a drought, and it's never going to happen that we are going to have a problem. Though, not this past summer, but the summer before, there was a weekend at the beginning of July when some neighborhoods, including Worcester Square and I think Fairhaven and East Haven, had brown water. And at the same time, Yale University was watering its athletic fields in the middle of the day. And I'm just wondering can you tell while water is being used who's using it, what they're using, and can you reach out to people and ask them not to cause a problem? Tiffany, do you have an answer to that?
Steve may be better able to answer about the field watering, but I recall from that 2020 the issue in particular was we had a very long dry period relatively early in the summer, which for us means we hit our high demand day, the day then people are using the most water, very early in the season. And what happens when people are using a lot of water is a lot of water is moving through the system. And that means that it can be moving a little bit faster than it would, you know, during a seasonally low period. Because that happened so early in the summer, it stirred up some things in our pipes. When that was going on, we did reach out to our known top water users in each of the towns and did contact them through our customer service to see if they could reduce their use right away to kind of mitigate that situation that was going on. We also reached out to some of the utilities who purchased water from us to see if they could rely on some of their own sources rather than using the pipes in our particular system that were experiencing those higher velocities and causing that issue. We did a lot more preparation this year in anticipation of that high demand period. We did change some of our operational practices. So we hope to be able to contribute some of the prevention of those incidences this summer due to some of those prevention measures that we took, as well as that WaterWise campaign and public outreach that you saw. I think that there is, although we have a new system where we can see our customers, it's not really intended to monitor or restrict people's use just to measure it for billing purposes. But it is something that we could leverage more in the future if we do get into a similar type of situation.
Thank you.
Steve, okay. Can you talk about watering?
Yeah, sure. I just had something to piggyback on that as well. Sometimes, you know, even with better system optimization and better protocol within our system, you'll still once in a while see some brownish hue to your water in the summer, just because those peak demands, the pipes aren't used to water flushing through it that quick because everyone's using it all at once. So sometimes it could dislodge a little sediment, but usually it passes within, you know, a 24-hour time frame or so. And we usually know exactly where that's happening because of the calls that we're getting. And we go out there, sample, make sure that, you know, nothing's an actual issue with the quality of the water. Sometimes it's usually just a different hue to it, but nothing actually is an issue with the drinkability of the water. So over time, it'll pass, and we usually flush that area at a different time so that it's going to happen more limited in the future. But as for the field watering, so when we do hit certain drought triggers, basically our company has a drought plan, and per our water storage that we hold as a whole, so with all of our reservoirs and groundwater combined, at a certain point we hit different triggers. So there'll be a normal trigger for the normal amount of water that we have, and then there's like, you know, we'll say a watch and then a warning, and each one past that is you want to limit the amount of water that you're distributing as much as possible. So when we hit these drought triggers, we do sometimes ask for not mandatory, but basically voluntary watering restrictions. So if everyone follows that or not, that's, you know, the only thing we can do is, like I keep on saying, is educate about it, because we're a non-regulatory agency. So we can't go around, finding people. There is a certain threshold where I believe we could do some mandatory aspects to it, but we really have never hit those. So it's more of a, hey, we're in a drought status right now. Please limit your watering or reduce it altogether. So that's really all we can do in terms of watering.
Thank you.
But that's also why we have the sustainability webinars in the summer as well, because that's when we're obviously seeing the most water demand. So we try to get people on the right on the right sustainability use of water that time of year.
Great. Thank you. Okay. So I know we have a lot of questions. I'm just going to ask the two I have on my list pretty quickly, and then we'll go on to try and answer everybody else's. So you just answered the question about whether there are limits on watering at athletic facilities. You know, we have two golf courses in New Haven. We have a public golf course, Alling Memorial, and we have Yale Golf Course. And during the season, those golf courses use up, Yale Golf Course, I know, uses at least 200,000 gallons of water a day. And I know they were getting it from the Regional Water Authority, but I hear that they've been trucking water in. So is there a limit on the amount of water golf courses use? And does the fact that they treat their grounds with pesticides cause them to use more water? I mean, I know that the pesticide contaminated water causes all kinds of problems, but I would like to know if they are using more water because they are watering things that perhaps they shouldn't. Also, Yale waters plastic grass. I don't know if all of you know that. I keep saying that there is a blue plastic field out my window, and every day from August to November, they watered it for an hour and a half at midday, which struck me as really bad. They also use pesticides and detergents on that field. And they also, so they have at least six plastic fields and acres of plastic. And I'm just wondering what kind of limits are placed on that. And if, you know, what happens to the water system with all this polluted water?
Right. So in terms of Yale Golf Course, I actually visited them a few years back. So I need to kind of jog my memory here. So so forgive me if my numbers aren't 100% correct, but they used to buy wholesale from us because they used to, at times when their ponds were too shallow, they would utilize our water for irrigation. But since then, I believe they've disconnected those water lines, and the only water lines that they have is the ones for the clubhouse and the locker room area and kind of the restaurant amenity area, we'll say. And they solely use the water from their ponds. And I believe they said that the only time that they've used our water is, I guess, in the first, let's see, the first couple weeks of the fall time when there may be a frost on the water and a frost on the grass, and their ponds are not able to be used because of their deep Department of Energy and Environmental Protection permit. That permit expires after, I want to say, sometime like October 1st. So in order to get the frost off the grass, they spritz the grass with, I believe, public water, but it's very little because it's not for irrigating purposes. It's just for frost management so that the golfers can get onto the course. So they're really not utilizing any more than their restaurant and amenity facility.
Thank you.
And as for part two, for the pesticide and herbicide portion of it, first off, I did review their best management practices and their pesticide management plan, and it is actually pretty impressive, their best management practices on that course. They do, I believe, all as far as chemicals go, they use pretty well-known good quality chemicals when it comes to non-synthetic, I believe it is. And when it comes to the products, they use them as little as possible, because obviously they don't want to be paying for it as well. But when you do apply those products, for the most part, they need to be watered in one time in a deeper and more shallower watering. And after that, you just resume with your normal watering.
Thank you. Okay. All right. So I think the last question I had from before, and then we'll get to everybody's questions, the questions of the people who are waiting patiently, is anybody working on grants for New Haven for our stretch of the Long Island Sound for water improvement and water quality and things like that? Someone sent me two documents about grant awards. One was from Fishways to Stormwater Management, $10.2 million in projects funded in Long Island Sound watershed. And the person didn't notice any New Haven grants. And the other one, I can't remember and the person notes that New Haven gets runoff from other towns upriver and possibly golf courses. Can we identify who is working on water quality quality in New Haven. And Madeline has just shared a couple of photos with you. And so if anybody wants to click on those, you'll be able to see. I think one is probably a picture of blue plastic grass being watered, and the other one, I can't remember what I told her to share. But anyway, let's go ahead and talk about grants for improvement of water quality.
Yeah, I don't really know of anything that New Haven's doing, just because, you know, even though we're located in New Haven, you know, we don't work for the town or anything. So I can't really, I don't think our WA can really speak for the grant opportunities that they have or haven't obtained.
Thank you. Okay, great. Madeline, maybe you could put in the chat those grant awards documents if you have them. Okay. Dawn, do you know anything about anyone who's working on water quality grants in New Haven?
We have the two upcoming Living Shoreline projects along the East Shore Park and Long Wharf Park, which are, coastal erosion, shoreline protection, but also provide water quality benefit. And those are combined almost 7,000 linear feet of along the harbor. I am not working on an active grant right now, but we're always, you know, working with our nonprofit partners on initiatives and grant initiatives.
Okay. Gary, do you have anything to add about this topic?
For grant funding, well, we have an active program with the Clean Water Fund out of Connecticut. Connecticut has a very active one to treat, you know, water pollution control problems. CSOs are big on their list here. Thank you to Senator Looney there. They've been providing a lot of money into that. We completed a couple of years ago now the $60 million upgrade at the facility. We're currently going into a $30 million upgrade at the East Street pump station there. And then we have various I&I programs and that are going through, and in addition to rehabbing those stations. So that's pretty much our grant funding goes through a different path, basically, than a lot of the other ones here. It's dedicated to water quality issues for that.
Thank you. Okay, so I see Madeline has put the two documents from Fishways to Stormwater and at Long Island Sound grants in the chat, so you can access them there. And there is a photo in one of the photos she put in is a picture of a car in a puddle. And that car is my car sitting in a puddle in the back of a parking lot behind art galleries on Whaley Avenue in Westville, where they are building a new building along the West River, which is enclosed in concrete banks, which was done by the Army Corps of Engineers. Kathy Fay shared that information with me, and we went to look at it one day because I didn't even know where the West River was. But I was told by the gallery director that every year those puddles get deeper. So I realize that is not an RWA or a Greater New Haven Water Pollution Control issue. That is more of a stormwater issue. And I realize that is a city issue, the stormwater situation, but I feel like all of these are water issues that need to be taken as a whole. Anyway, so that's why that photo is there. Anyway, I think we're going to go on to answer everybody else's questions. And I lost the whole beginning of the chat because I had to log off my computer and log back on. And by the way, we've been joined by Alder Adam Marchand. Hello, Adam. And by Anstris Farwell of Urban Design League. Hello, Anstris. So welcome to both of you. And I hope that I can tap maybe Madeline to read the questions one by one and see if we can answer some of them, if that would be okay with all of you. And Senator Looney, whenever you have to leave, we greatly appreciate your being here. Thank you very much. And we look forward to knowing everything about water.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Madeline, what was the first question that came at the very beginning of the
question for Gary? Does GNHWPCA have any gray water initiatives or demonstration projects?
No, the gray water part is usually more into the development of the residence area there. So, you know, which because whatever you can do to reduce that water coming to us is the benefit to you. So we don't actively push that part of it.
Okay. Anyone who has anything to add about any of these questions, if anyone has any answers at any time, feel free to chime in. Okay, next question.
Question for Steve. If we smell something awry in the sewage system, for example, spilled oil, whom should we contact?
I think that one's actually for Gary.
Yeah. Yeah, any spill there, just so you know, and I think there's something, a question further down too. We have a 24-hour number, 203-466-5260. It's a 24-hour number. We answer it there. If the operator is away from the desk, you know, an answering service picks it up, and we'll get it there. Now, that's a complaint for backups, spills, odor complaints.
Can you state that again? Sorry, I picked my pen up too late. What's the number?
203-466-5260.
Thank you.
That to us at the last meeting, and we did put it somewhere public. We'll do it again. Thank you. Yeah. And you gave us a copy of the form. We will put that somewhere public again, too. Thank you.
Yeah, so that's kind of what we handle there. I guess one thing I did see in there, too, is, you know, if you have oil, if it's an oil spill, there is really a spills division out of Connecticut DEP, just so that, you know, if you see oil on the road like that, that's not there. But for any other, you know, odor, if something's funny like that, you know, feel free to call. We, you know, look into it and see what's going on there.
Great. Okay. Madeline, what's the next question?
For Mr. Zrelek, someone once told me garbage disposals are terrible for wastewater treatment load, more organic debris. What's your take on that?
Very true. You know, grinding up all that food garbage there adds to the organic strength of the wastewater. One of our most expensive steps in the treatment plant is aeration, bubbling air into it for our bacteria treatment of that. 40% of our budget goes there. And so adding to the organic strength will put a larger demand on us. We do not allow them when we go into commercial facilities, and especially the state ordinances. If you have a grease trap and everybody, who has a kitchen of a certain size that has or is serving meals to the public has to have a grease trap in there. They do not allow grease traps to be going into, a grease separation tank. So by that, we don't, and we also have that in our ordinance not to have them. So we don't like them, especially on a commercial end of it there. On the household wastes, we can't do much to go into people's homes. So we don't do that.
Thank you. Okay, Chris, I do remember you had a question very early on. Why don't you ask it? Or Madeline, can you see Chris's question at the very beginning? Oh,
sorry.
It's okay.
Sorry, I was in a chat. I'm very interested in what's going on with the forests that are around all the water authority properties. I noticed that there's a fair amount of invasives everywhere that's affecting the trees, but also the storm intensities have increased, and there's a lot of wind throws. And so we're not having a new forest come in. And I've had a number of people ask me questions about it too. So I'm just curious as to what the Regional Water Authority is thinking in this arena.
Right. So you've definitely seen correctly. We have just invasives galore. We have barberry, you know, bittersweet, multiflora rose. We have, you know, you name it, we have it when it comes to invasives. It's kind of Connecticut as a whole. Deer tracking is a huge part of it. And just the overabundance of invasives already in the forest. One thing we've done to combat invasives altogether is we're actually the first water company in Connecticut, probably many more states as well, to hire a invasive species specialist. So this gentleman was hired to look directly into invasive species. So he's actually currently fairly new position. I would say 3 to 4 years now he's been here, but he's working on GIS, which is geographic information systems, to plot out what invasives we have and where they are. And not only that, but he goes down to the field and does small scale, tries to do eradications of the current invasives that we have. And this is a job that's really we're never going to eradicate all the invasive species. If you know anything about them, that's just the way it's going to be. But we're also looking into natural degradation of them, like, you know, releasing different insects to control, and looking into different treatments, like flame treatments on barberry. And we're actually utilizing some of those treatments currently. And when I say flame, it's not not controlled burns. Just during rainy days, they go out with torches, and they actually torch the root system so that they don't come back. The other thing that we're doing is drone footage. We're working with UConn currently, and we are at the very beginning of spring, before leaf out on trees. Invasives tend to pop up and with their leaves earlier than tree foliage. So we have a very short window to do it, but we're working with UConn to do drone footage to gather imagery on where the invasives, and in particular barberry, are within our forests, so that we can better understand where they are and how to eradicate them.
Well, I would say canopy's king, and you got to get out and just save your canopy. Cut the bittersweet. Instead of spending a lot of time analyzing, data-driven, all that stuff, you're losing your canopy. And when your canopy's gone, it's not coming back unless right. you spend a now, lot more dollars.
He's out there probably, I would say, 70 to 80% of the time. So the data portion is just kind of fluff for the bad days, you know, the days that you can't physically be out there. But most of the time they're out there cutting and doing the treatments that they need to do. It's like I said, if you don't have a fleet of people, even 100 or more out there, it's just never going to fully get done. But we're doing the best we could to at least manage those. And also we do controlled timber harvest as well. And in part with those timber harvests, I think someone mentioned weather events. You know, if you have old damaged trees in your forest, you know, they're going to come down. Anyways, and we have timber harvest that basically manage our forests actually in a really, really good way to promote new succession. And we see that through the woodcutter permits and the forestry efforts for forest management. We're seeing pretty good results with early succession, because we in Connecticut, we have just a ton of old growth, and that old growth really just shades out the forest so that new growth can't start to grow.
And what one last thing for you specifically, have you seen a change in the water quality as a result of all these invasive species and the wind events?
I can't fully answer that just because we probably don't have any, you know, concluding data on it. The one thing that I could say is that we are trying to manage the, in particular, the barberry closer to the reservoirs, because barberry has been basically linked to degrading the leaf litter on the soil ground. So it does cause more erosion. So we've been focusing on it more on the scale of nearer to the reservoir. But we don't have any data concluding if it's, if because of the invasive species, we have better or worse water quality. It hasn't been, the invasive has been around long enough, but we just don't have the resources to gather that data yet.
Okay. Thank you.
Great, thanks. Chris, I suggest you stay in touch with Steve for future reference. So
yeah,
Steve,
I can get you in touch with our invasive species specialist as well.
That would be great.
Yeah, I talked with them.
Oh, you did. Okay.
Oh, okay.
So two things. We're going to go on and ask and answer more questions, but I forgot that we need to vote on the minutes of the meeting, which Dawn very nicely took. So thank you, Dawn. So I would ask each of the Environmental Advisory Council members, please, to put a thumbs up in your box or to raise your hand or something. Yeah. Okay. If you approve of the minutes, that way we don't have to stop for that. I already saw Kevin doing it. Anyway. Okay. Got it. I saw Floristine. Thank you. Okay. And Iris and Kathy, thank you. Okay. So now let's see, the next question is, does the Water Authority have plans to incentivize residents to purchase rain barrels?
Yes, we have an active program. This is to the GNH WPCA. We have an active rain barrel program that we put out to in for combined. We want to put them in combined areas, but we'll give them to the whole thing there where we supply the materials, and the New Haven Bioregional Group through Frank Panzarella will train you on how to assemble it and be able to use it there. So we support that part of it there, but I'm not sure what the RWA is also doing.
Yeah, we have a rain barrel program as well. In the summer, we actually purchase, I believe we have people pre-purchase the barrels and we sell them for a discounted rate that they're what they're actually worth. And I believe this is in the summertime. We usually blast out an announcement for it prior, and then people order them individually, and then we order the amount that we need, and then they come to our facility. I think there's a 2-day time frame maybe where they can pick them up. They pre-purchase them, pick them up, and that's a program that we have going on every year.
Great. Okay. I wonder if we could get information about both of those programs to send out with our minutes so that people who want rain barrels will know where to look for them. That would be really useful. Thanks. Okay. So let's see. I'm going on to more questions. Let's see. Could the Greater New Haven Water Pollution Control Authority install solar panels on the East Shore facility roof?
We haven't looked at the roof yet. We've entertained, you know, we have a lot more surface area on the tanks. The problem with doing some of that, you know, is some of the existing structure that's there to make sure that they can handle some of the wind load there. We had previously looked at a windmill that was not going to work as well. So we are entertaining some of that. On the roof, a lot of our roofs are very busy with equipment, so we have to be concerned. That's why we've looked at some of our tanks that we have and try to look at doing something there.
Okay, thanks. Let's see. And what are your plans, Gary, to stop sewage sludge incineration in New Haven that adversely affects all of the residents who live downwind from the toxic emissions, in addition to the age status of the incinerator? Is it time to retire this incinerator?
Let's see, a number of years ago, we did a sludge study there, which looked at some of the costs and all that to move away from that. You know, part of the thing is that we have a large capital investment that's there. We have an extensive pollution control equipment on it, Venturi scrubber. We use our own effluent water to wash out the particulates there. We have a trace scrubber after that, followed by a wet electrostatic precipitator that gets a lot of colloidal and metal material out of the stream. We have a regenerative thermal oxidizer for any hydrocarbons to get on there. So we do have issues with, you know, the metals are in there. They are all in compliant ones there. We've just gone through the second phase of the pollution control regs from EPA. They came down and because they put in all these new regs and then went through all the incinerators. We're compliant with that new ones there. So at the present time, you know, we're not looking at any capital investment to another technology for our sludge disposal.
Okay. Thanks. Let's see. what else? I don't know who asked this. So this is for the RWA. If the source of our water is atmospheric deposition of contaminants problematic, i.e. PFAS from industry and incineration.
And I can answer this question.
Thanks, Tiffany.
Yeah, we have done some fairly extensive testing for PFAS and PFOA at all of our water sources of supply, and have not found any results of significance. So no issues with any of our surface water bodies. There is one groundwater facility that we are monitoring that may be of concern if levels change over time, but it's currently below the thresholds that we would look for for health.
Okay. And Stephanie Fitzgerald asks about lead pipes in older homes. How does RWA treat water so residents are not harmed?
In terms of lead, as you may know, we collect literally hundreds of thousands of water sample results throughout the system every month. And lead is certainly one of the tests that we perform on those samples. That is very closely monitored. Those selection points are determined in coordination with the Department of Public Health to make sure that they are representative and in fact may represent the worst areas of the system to make sure that we're in compliance with those. In the early 1990s, the Regional Water Authority had a really big initiative to remove all of the lead service lines that were owned by the Water Authority, and we do believe that we were quite successful in doing that. However, today, the piece that was missing there is the portion of the service line that's owned by the customers and certainly pipes within their houses. Unfortunately, because those are not owned by the Water Authority, we don't have great records on the materials of those pipes. It is something that we are working with all the information that we have to gather any information on where that remaining lead may be out in the system, particularly on the customer side, but it is very difficult. Some of our records go back to the 1860s. So as you can imagine, compiling that information and then turning it into a response and action program is quite difficult. It is something that we and many other utilities in Connecticut are undertaking at this time. And we have shown in our budget forecast investments in order to address anything that we do determine is either unable to be identified in terms of the material or is likely to be lead. I know that that's going to be a really important discussion up at the state level in terms of the funding and who's going to pay for that, particularly if it is in on those residential owned sides of the system. So I think there's still some uncertainty on how exactly that's going to be worked out. What is a water utility's responsibility for that? But anything that we can do for providing the information that would lead to those answers, we are currently pursuing that. It is under contract with one of our consultants to assist with going through those old records and research and trying to figure out, even though we may have removed our lead portion, what may still remain. It's a tricky thing to solve.
Yes, it is. Thank you. So Iris asks, regarding pollution prevention, how can we possibly collaborate regarding banning/phasing out pesticides and leaf blowers that use fossil fuels? And she also wants to know if there are any reservoirs that have bike trails. Anybody want to tackle that?
I just want to say I've been participating on the public meetings for the water planning council for the past 5 years. I'm participating in most of the meetings, and I just posed that question on their last meeting, and because we talk a lot about conservation. And somehow, pollution prevention is within a lot of the water. It's a lot of the sections of the water plan, but it is not, it feels to me that it like falls between the cracks, like it's in some sections, and it's a very cost-effective way to maintain our water quality. And one of the reasons I joined this council with Laura is because I was I came to Adam, or my elder, and asked him, my neighbors are using pesticides, and these are considered non-point pollution, and there's like no control. And I really love that Steve Vitko shared about the pollinator path. I did not know that RWA is doing that. It's wonderful. So I'm frustrated with my neighbors. And so when I asked that at the council on the state level, they, because I said, well, we need more support, so I won't have to fight with my neighbors. And they said, well, a lot of these resolutions come from the town. So I think it's kind of an interaction between state and the town. So I think I just wanted, like, if the Department of Health would say, you know, we know these pesticides are not good for our health, we don't need more research, we need a little bit more support that it will be easier for us to educate the citizens about this. If there was some, I don't know, I just feel that there's no clarity about people who are not involved, like you, most of the people on this panel are. A lot of people are not aware. Their gardener tells them to put this, so they put this. So I think I lost where I started to talk about, but I think you got it.
Yeah, we did. Gary, you look like you might want to say something about this.
Oh, no, I didn't have anything on that part of it there.
Okay. I see that Tiffany has put a recreation area chart in the chat box. We will send that out so all of you have access to the RWA recreation maps. Thank you. Very kind of you. Okay.
A pony real quick, if you don't mind. I have to hop off in just a moment. I have one quick thing I wanted to say, and actually Iris kind of teed it up for me perfectly. So just want to make sure the members are aware. I'm working with the Water Planning Council State Water Plan Implementation Working Group Outreach and Education Subgroup. How's that for a mouthful? The water pollution folks don't have that problem. We're working right now on an outreach and education plan to basically disseminate all the work that went into the state water plan. And a big part of that is educating folks on the water conservation piece that you brought up earlier, Laura. And so it may seem like there's nothing really happening on that, but we're kind of getting all of our ducks in a row right now and putting together kind of a long-term outreach and education plan to engage with the municipalities and, you know, and with the water providers and all the other stakeholders on exactly what that plan does. So that's going to be something that we're going to want to come back down the road and talk to you all about in a little bit more detail, so we can hopefully partner with you and Greater New Haven Water Pollution and some of the other folks to kind of get the word out to New Haven residents about what they can do on water conservation, how pesticides are impacting our watershed and all this different kind of thing that's so important. So I just wanted to put that out there and just say thank you all for setting up this opportunity for community conversation.
You're welcome. Thank you for joining us, Lou. So I just want to say that I keep hearing more and more about pesticides that I was already concerned with, but as we know, pesticides were sprayed at the airport three times this summer, or three times from the spring to the summer at least. And I heard that the airport was flooded all summer long, which means that the pesticides got into the water in the neighborhood, the water, whatever, not the drinking water, but they got into the pesticides got into the general water there. And I understand from UI that they spray pesticides for vegetation removal along their tracks. And so we're just getting a huge inundation of pesticides from places you don't even imagine or think about getting pesticides, which pollutes water and pollutes soil from and pollutes the air. So I want us all to be cognizant of that as we try to work on plans to mitigate some of these issues. Okay, I think Mary Woolsey had a question, if Mary's still here and it hasn't been answered.
It has been answered. It was about gray water, and Gary said they didn't have any program. And I don't know if Steve or Tiffany, there's anything that you have going with gray water, especially for larger facilities.
I mean, our treatment plants do recycle some of their wastewaters back to the head of the plant. Those are just waters that may be used during the treatment process, and nothing to do with actually going to be used. So we do try and make our water treatment plants as efficient as possible by sending any waters that is used during the process back to the head of the plant to be treated again. But I don't believe that we have any particular gray water initiatives. We don't have a lot of water use at our facilities other than that, which is related to the treatment and production of drinking water. I believe in Connecticut that not gray water systems, which are distinctly separate from your drinking water system, right? So you'd have parallel pipes, gray water, and drinking right. water yep. under the system. So that is not something that I'm aware that the Regional Water Authority is working with anyone in particular on or promoting at this point in time. Steve, okay. Have a different perspective?
No, I don't know too much about the gray water. I do know that that it is allowed in certain states of the country and is not allowed in other states of the country. The states that it is allowed to be utilized in, you do need a licensed professional to install your system. But I don't, off the top of my head, I don't believe Connecticut is one of those who are, for residents at least, is allowed to cooperate with the gray water program. Maybe Gary has more on that, but that rings a bell in my head. I believe that's the way it is.
Yeah, I think there's some really, I think it's public health and those, and look at the gray water and want to make sure that it's isolated and separate. There are some facilities around, I've heard, if they build it, they may put that in there, for going on there. So actually, you got me off on a train of thought there. What was the question that we were answering there?
We were done with that. I think that was
gray water. I think we've.
Yeah.
You know what I do want to say there is one of the big things in the industry is the purple lines now, where it's reuse of the effluent that's coming out of the treatment plant. Unfortunately, though, like here, I think there's a lot of water, so the demand isn't as great. But when you're out there is a lot of water reuse.
Water reuse, I believe, is not allowed in Connecticut. So that right. means that. Your drinking water system is somewhat interrelated to that gray water system rather than being completely separate. There are concerns, I believe, at the regulatory level with public health and making sure that system would be safe.
Great. I just want to make a comment on that.
Okay. You know what, Iris?
We don't have time.
We're
okay.
getting to the end of our meeting. So sorry, we can continue this discussion later. We are so thrilled that you all came to answer our questions, of which we have many. I see Kathy has her hand raised. And Jean Connolly, I know you've been working on the light pollution on York Street issue from a roof garden. I suggest we table that to our next meeting. As I said before, we're not meeting in February. Instead, we encourage everyone to go to the Puro 101 webinar on January 18th and to the Climate Emergency Mobilization Task Force meeting at 6:00 next Tuesday to hear from Dawn's intern, who's going to discuss the greenhouse gas inventory. So we will try to send out all the stuff that we discussed in minutes, and we will send out a link to the transcript, the audio transcript, which Dawn will kindly do for us. And Kathy, do you need to say something?
I just wanted to make sure people knew about the meeting on the webinar on the 18th. That is going to be with Chairwoman Maritza Gillette. And there's a reason why, you know, it's not just about PURA, it is with the head of PURA. So a lot of the questions that we might have already had, we may have answered, and we'll be able to ask deeper questions. And I also want to remind folks that unlike most of the water utilities in Connecticut, the RWA is not considered a water utility, and some of us on the EAC already know this, and we've met with folks from Consumer Council. We understand that you're not under PURA, but the electric utilities are. I don't know about the WPCA, or, you know, Gary's WPCA anyway, but just reminding folks, and maybe Gary can tell us whether you guys are...
Yeah, the WPCAs are not regulated under PURA.
Okay, thanks.
Great. Okay, so we will reconvene in March. Hopefully, we will have news about a leaf blower public hearing. And for all of those who came tonight, thank you very, very much. I'm going to try and get all the information from the chat put in some form that we can I'll access it. And thank you, Dawn, for everything you do to make these meetings possible. Madeline, thank you very much for your help with sharing things with everybody. And if anyone has anything final to say, please say it now. Okay, well then I suggest that we end this meeting. And thank you all for coming. And we're not going to take an official vote, but Happy New Year, everybody. And we will see you again soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Happy New Year.
Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thanks.